Tell her no. This was the first hit for The Zombies. Colin Blunstone, the charismatic singer, and Rod Argent, the jazz-inspired, very talented keyboardist. And they hailed from St. Albans, which is a neighborhood just north of London, back in, I think they formed in 1961, and they're still out there, still performing. The two originals, Blunstone and Argent, and last year they released a very critically acclaimed album, Still Got That Hunger. So The Zombies are still with us. We are talking Howard Hughes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. I wanted to share a couple of more interesting or bizarre facts about the billionaire eccentric recluse. Howard Hughes became so afraid of germs, he wouldn't let anyone touch the knobs of his television. And then later, he became convinced that the tube emitted germ-filled rays. And again, this is all from a book called Howard Hughes, The Untold Story by Peter Harry Brown. During his stays at the Desert Inn in Vegas, he made the chef cut each piece of chocolate cake he ordered into an exact square, which he checked with a ruler. If they weren't exactly square, he sent them back. Join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained on his TV show, Beyond Belief. A brand new episode is available this coming Wednesday. Beyond Belief TV with George Norrie. Sign up and start watching episodes right now at beyondbelief.com. Back with more of my conversation with Douglas Wellman and Mark Music, Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Douglas Wellman, Mark Music, co-authors of Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, stay with us. Eva McClellan, the woman who married the man who turned out to be Howard Hughes, after Panama, I understand they moved to Alabama. Why Alabama?
Well, they after Panama, they left in 1972 and actually went to Arizona for about 2 years. And moved a couple different places in Arizona, and then in 1975 is when they went back to Alabama, which is where she was from. And so they went back to that location where she was from. Now the other thing we found out is that there's also a huge aircraft facility there in Troy, Alabama, at that point in time also. So there might have been some other connections to get back into that area. But it was a place that they could kind of operate and live and hide.
And how did they live? Because this man had so much money. How did they live? Did they live well or did they live poorly?
They lived very, I guess, the way they wanted to. From money viewpoint, Eva had a civil service retirement check, and she had Social Security, probably a small Social Security check. And he was actually receiving an Air Force disability check that the identity that he took earned, but he was getting a check, and then he had access to money. He had a Chase Manhattan bank account, and he had access to money if he needed it. But the way they lived, you really didn't need a lot of money. You know, if you're living in a shack, or living in a small house, or living in a trailer in the woods, you don't need a lot of money. And they didn't have it, but they had access to whatever they wanted.
And what did Eva... go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, one of the things that's very interesting about this is that Nick didn't cash Werner's retirement checks, typically. He would just throw them in a stack. But he was also a compulsive shopper for tools and technology, and he would order all of these tools, and there was a UPS lady by the name of Dana Perry, I think is her name, Dana?
Sure. Yes.
And she every week would pull up in her UPS truck and deliver all of these boxes of tools and technical things, and then Nick would never open the boxes. He had a trailer where he would just put the boxes in there and store them. So he had plenty of money, but didn't cash his checks, and it was just a very odd situation.
And how did Eva describe their married life? Was he good to her?
Not really.
I think there was times that he was very, very good to her, very charming, very a friendly man. But she said his personality could change instantly into this verbally vicious man. And that's what Eva didn't like. She had to be very, very careful of that. And that's one time that she would just leave, too. She couldn't put up with him. So there's one time 9 months, one time 6 months, one time 4 months. She'd just leave him. But they'd always get back together. He knew where she was. He had somebody, you know, in contact with her. He knew where she was. They always got back together. And bottom line is, she just loved him. You know, sometimes she couldn't put up with him, but she loved the guy.
And was he off traveling, disappearing for long stretches of time, running his company as well?
Well, that's one of the interesting things, is that whenever Eva would get fed up and leave him, she actually bought a little island out in the Caribbean. Whenever she would get upset with him and move off to her island for a while, those all coincide with times when Howard Hughes shows up for a meeting with someone. So while she was hiding in her island, he went back to being Mr. Howard Hughes and conducted some business.
All right, let's go to the international line, and Tyler is checking in from London, Ontario, just down the 401 a spell. Tyler, welcome to Coast AM. Is Tyler there? All right, he should be there. He's being reclusive. All right, we'll try Tyler a little bit later. Let me just ask this before I get back to the calls. Did Howard Hughes or Vernon Nicely, in Eva McClellan's presence, display any of that eccentric behavior that he was famous for?
Oh, absolutely. He always wore gloves. Typically, when they were out at what they called the ranch, his wardrobe consisted of a miner's hard hat, short rubber boots, and gloves. That was it. He ran around naked. But he wore those gloves in the house as well as out. He was rarely seen without gloves because he didn't want to touch anything.
And also, I met with Eva many, many times, and we'd go to a store or something, take her to the store. And Eva, as you walk through the lot, Eva would say, "Oh, don't step on that oil spot. Don't step on that oil spot." Nick always said, "Don't ever do that." And so some of his germaphobe things actually had rubbed off onto her.
All right. East of the Rockies, Cliff is in Bristol, Tennessee. Cliff, good morning, good evening. Welcome to Coast.
Hey, guys. Great show. Awesome show. Very informative. Has anyone done any DNA testing? And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Cliff. So DNA testing around the ranch in Alabama.
That's an actually terrific question, because it plays into something that in the second edition, we located two of his illegitimate children and matched them by DNA. Now, the Hughes DNA exists, but no one is allowed to get at it. It's at a place, a facility in Texas. But shortly after the first book came out, I received a call from a woman who identified herself as Cindy Hughes and said she was the daughter of Hughes. And she said, "I'm not even going to tell you the story because I know it sounds crazy. I have a private investigator who will vouch for me. And here's his phone number." So I called him. He was in Texas. And he said, "Yeah, she's the real deal." Well, it turned out that he was also the private investigator that worked on the Mormon Will case, if you remember that, with, you know, Melvin Dubler, the gas station attendant.
Right. Howard and Me, very famous movie.
So he not only verified Cindy, but he verified that Melvin Dubler was the right guy. Then Cindy found another man by the name of John McDonald, and his picture is in the book, and I think it's actually on her website, too. He is another son of Howard Hughes, and Mark matched them with DNA. So there is a DNA match on them.
But did those illegitimate children of Howard Hughes, does their DNA match up with Vernon Nicely, alias Howard Hughes?
Okay, the Vernon Nicely, I went down that path for about 5 years with the DNA expert. And we had five or six things that we thought would yield DNA from Vernon. None of them yielded DNA. So I wish we had it. I wish we had it, but we didn't have. We can't get. We haven't been able to get a Vernon Nicely's DNA. And
so
even if we did,
Eva didn't keep a lock of his hair. Nothing.
Howard's is off, hidden away somewhere.
Well, but working backwards, because there's another book called Family Secret, written by a man named Warren Hull, and he is John McDonald's cousin, and he put together the story of the McDonald family. As it turns out, that John McDonald thought a man named Robert McDonald was his father, but his mother had had an affair with Howard Hughes. McDonald's grandfather was president of Hughes Tool at one time. It gets very, very complicated here, but there's no question that John is the son of Howard Hughes.
And speaking of John McDonald, the illegitimate son of Howard Hughes, John's, I guess, adopted father or stepfather, Robert, was he not involved in the Bugsy Siegel killing?
Absolutely. And that's one of the strange things about writing this book. It just went everywhere. Once we got in there, it took on a life of its own. John thought Robert McDonald was his father. As I say, his mother had had an affair with Hughes. Everybody assumed John was Robert's father, but he wasn't. His grandfather, Archie McDonald, was president of Hughes Tool. They were a very wealthy, socially connected family in Los Angeles. Bob McDonald, unfortunately, was a womanizer and a drinker and a big gambler. His wife, Betty McDonald, her mother was married into the Los Angeles mob, which was kind of an interesting connection. When John McDonald started gambling heavily, he got in debt to the Los Angeles mob. He also started beating Betty. Betty's godfather was Jack Dragna, who was the head of the Los Angeles mob. And it got to the point where Dragna, between being owed a lot of money and having his goddaughter beaten up, decided he was going to take out Bob McDonald. Bob McDonald joined the army, this is during World War II, and became a war hero in Germany. When he came back, they gave him a break because he was a war hero, but he got into debt with Dragna again, and Dragna pretty much had it with him, and he came up to him one day and said, "You owe me $25,000. You get three options. You pay me the $25,000. In lieu of the $25,000, I've got the contract to kill Bugsy Siegel. So in lieu of the $25,000 debt, you kill Bugsy Siegel. Third option is I kill you." So Bob McDonald got a World War II surplus M1 carbine and shot Bugsy Siegel. And then after that, he had something of a breakdown. John believes that it was a combined, what they would call
post-traumatic stress disorder. And
yeah, exactly.
Guilt, perhaps.
It was that, not only from his war experiences, where he was wounded as well as becoming a hero, but then having to kill Bugsy Siegel against his will. And one day, Bob McDonald called Betty, his wife, into the room, and he shot her with the same carbine that he shot
Bugsy Siegel, and then
committed suicide with the rifle, and he did all of this in front of John.
Oh, my.
So John had an incredibly traumatic life, and Cindy has also had a traumatic life, and both of these people are just terrific people. I'm just so glad that we got to know them through this project. But they've had tough lives, and the whole McDonald's story and Cindy's story are both incredibly interesting.
Well, you got more than you bargained for when you started to research this book, as if Howard Hughes'
life
wasn't enough. Right. Let's go west of the Rockies, and someone who wishes to remain anonymous, checking in from Summerlin, California. Hello, anonymous or alias. Welcome to Coast to Coast. All right.
Anonymous.
He is. That's very anonymous. He can't get any more anonymous than that. All right. We have another caller. Is it a Jim on the line?
Hello?
Hi there.
Yeah, I
Jim from Marysville, Washington. Yes, go ahead.
I have a couple of quick questions. I'd like to know if Howard Hughes' kidney failure contributed to his bizarre behavior. And secondly, I'd like to know if he was involved with the mob.
All right, Jim, thank you for those great questions. So kidney failure, is that possibly linked to his behavior?
The stand-in, the guy who actually died on the airplane, was not Hughes, but he was not treated well at all. He was emaciated. He was mentally ill. He did suffer from basically complete organ failure because nobody was taking care of him. And the fact is, after Hughes's official death in 1976, as far as everyone else was concerned, you know, the sooner they could, no, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. The sooner that the stand-in died, basically, the quicker everyone could get out of this deal as having to take care of him. But yes, kidney failure, complete organ failure. His skin had become so thin that his bones actually protruded. So he was very, very poorly taken care of.
And let's talk a little bit about who this stand-in is. You mentioned him off the top. Was this Brooks Randall?
Brooks Randall was one of them. There's a couple. And his picture is on your website. It's also on our website, which is www.boxeshowardhughessecrets.com. I noticed you also put that up on your website. Thank you for that. Brooks Randall was a bit actor. He looked like Hughes. He looked like a younger Hughes because he was about 15 years younger. And he was used by the Hughes organization starting about 1957 to stand in for Hughes. In fact, they actually staged photo shoots, and this is documented in a couple of books, where they would set up Randall and a couple of other people, and then they would use shoot from a ways back with a telephoto lens, so it looked like the entire thing had been captured surreptitiously.
And the stand-in who was living in deplorable conditions at the Desert Inn, who was that?
Well, that's a good question. To be honest with you, I thought it was Randall. And I thought it was Randall who died on the airplane coming from Acapulco. And we went right up to publication when I discovered that was wrong. There is another man. There were more than one stand-ins. Randall is the one who everybody is most familiar with, but there was another man by the name of Vance Cooper, and it's believed by a couple of people that he was actually the one. I understand, from what I understand on this, he was a drug addict, and it's speculated that he was really the one who died on the airplane, and that was a couple of people speculate on that. One of them was Hollywood columnist James Bacon, who knew Hughes. He speculated that it was Cooper who died on the aircraft. And another researcher by the name of Mae Brussel was the co-author of a big Playboy article that ran in the 70s, and she believed that it was Cooper.
Well, if it comes from Mae Brussel, I think you could bank on it. I mean, she was a terrific researcher, JFK assassination research, and others. So, anyway, we'll take a time out, come back, get to some more calls for Douglas Wellman, Mark Music, Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. Here are the Struts, my latest favorite band who hail from England. Could Have Been Me on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. And you can say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T, Richard Serrett, S-Y-R-E-T-T. Coming up at the top of the hour, Josiah's Fire, Autism Stole His Words, God Gave Him a Voice. We'll speak with Josiah's mother, Tawny Cullen, and the author of Josiah's Fire, after the top of the hour. We continue to delve into the secret life of Howard Hughes. I just wanted to share a couple more interesting factoids about the reclusive billionaire. Howard Hughes was determined to learn about flying, and so the billionaire apparently anonymously applied for and got a job as a baggage handler with American Airlines for $115 per month. I'm not sure if that's apocryphal or not. Maybe I'll check that with our guests here in a few moments. This one, well, it's a little dicey, but after learning that he had contracted venereal disease from a girlfriend, Howard Hughes ordered all his clothes and bed linens burned in a bonfire at his Los Angeles estate. I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to be presenting a live event, an exclusive live event here in Toronto, Saturday, October the 15th. It's called Take a Walk on the Dark Side, Rock and Roll Myths, Legends, and Curses, featuring the Fox Mulder of Rock, R. Gary Patterson. Plus, we'll have some special Skype appearances by Peggy Sue Guerin, Buddy Holly's muse and good friend, Leo Lyons, the bass player with 10 Years After, and Bill Harry, lifelong friend of all the Beatles and the publisher of the legendary Mercy Beat magazine. Take a Walk on the Dark Side with R. Gary Patterson, Saturday, October the 15th at the J.J.R. McLeod Auditorium here in Toronto. For more information and to purchase tickets, you can go to the live events page on my website, strangeplanet.ca. Back to my conversation with Douglas Wellman, Mark Music, co-authors of Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, when Coast to Coast AM continues. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you, coming to you from Coast Toronto affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. Douglas Wellman, Mark Music, stay with us until the top of the hour. The book is Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes. Once again, there is some information, material on Howard Hughes that serves as a nice primer for this discussion on the carousel at coasttocoastam.com. Before we dive back into the calls, when the stand-in for Howard Hughes died on that plane on the way to Houston, did Ava discuss with you her reaction to that? Did she think that was a sick, cruel joke, or was she on side with the deception?
It was kind of funny. Mark, you want to tell the story?
Yeah, Ava told me this several times. They were living in a little house west of Troy, Alabama, and they're listening to it on the radio because he would not let her have a TV. He said, TVs are worthless. We're not going to have one. So they're listening to it on the radio. At this point, the aides were down the road about half a mile, and the aides were doing his business and meeting with him. And Eva would see that, the aides meeting with him. But it was big news at that point in time because Howard was this enigma for 20 years. And Eva says to Nick, she says, the public is going to realize that there's something very strange about this because they're trying to get the body in the ground too quick. And Nick says to Eva, you really know who your friends are when you fake your death and you see who shows up at the service. Well, at the service was 24 people. 23 of them were cousins, most of whom he'd never met. And the 24th one was a CIA representative. So they did have some discussion there. I did want to add something about this long-haired, long-fingernailed gentleman. Many of the books describe him as being 20 years older than Howard. And so we think there was an age difference in there. But that's all part of the mystery of this, which is still going on. There's still bits and pieces of this story that we don't know. We don't have the knowledge of at this point. And that is one of them, is who was that guy who was really standing in for him with the long-haired, long fingernails, who was a drug addict, we believe, and who was standing in for him for about 7 years. Who was that guy? There's still questions on that.
And he was interred at
one
in a family plot?
One interesting question regarding the funeral is these aides who supposedly took care of Hughes, they took care of somebody, not one single one of them showed up for the funeral. So if that really was Howard Hughes being buried, why would his aides not, you know?
That's very telling indeed, very telling. And was the stand-in interred in the plot, the Howard Hughes plot?
Supposedly he is buried in the cemetery in Houston. It's just west of downtown, Glenwood Cemetery, I believe it is. So supposedly he's buried into there. Whether he's still there or not, I mean, who knows? But that's where he is. But we do know for certain that if you dig those up, the DNA of that body that's buried in the Howard Hughes grave, and the two, that are buried in the parents' grave, they will never, ever match.
And Vernon Nicely, who was Howard Hughes, what happened to him upon his demise?
He was cremated. He was cremated. And so, and I actually helped Eva distribute the ashes for him, which is what the story is written around, is that trip down into Florida where she wanted the ashes delivered and distributed. And so that's what happened to the real Howard Hughes.
All right. Ryan is in Vancouver, Washington. Ryan, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Yeah,
well, Ryan. Go ahead, Ryan.
How's it going? Sorry about that. I'll keep this brief. I was just wondering if Howard Hughes actually had a true legitimate case of obsessive compulsive disorder, because I got a bad case of OCD. Anyway, you guys have a good night. Thank you.
All right, Ryan, thank you.
Yeah, his mother was very phobic, and that did, he did sort of inherit that characteristic. He was phobic about germs, and I think OCD might have been one of those characteristics.
All right, wildcard line, Mike, West Palm Beach, Florida. Mike, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Good evening. I wonder if you could clear up something for me that I've wondered about for over 50 years. From 1961 to 1963, I worked on the Nevada test. For two of those years, I took care of the communications at Area 51. Normally, I would go out about 9 o'clock in the morning when I would get there. And once I cleared in, then I'd go have breakfast. On a number of occasions, I could see a white, brand new, or nearly new Lockheed Constellation parked down at the approach end of the runway. And I would run into the flight crew in the mess hall. There was the pilot and co-pilot. The pilot, at that time I was 5'9". The pilot was taller than me, a rather robust man. And I didn't give it any thought at the time other than, gee, that's interesting. I wonder why they're using Lockheed planes. I've come to find out a lot of things since then, but this was 1961 and 60.
Mike, are you saying that you suspect that pilot might have been Howard Hughes?
That's what I'm saying. I've wondered that for over 50 years.
And why would you come to that conclusion?
Just from the descriptions that I've gotten, like I say.
All right.
I was.
And was he known to fly that type of plane? Was he known to fly that type of plane?
Well, it was a plane the TWA bought. That was a TWA plane, except that this plane was all white, and with no markings other than tail numbers. But and it was just a regular Constellation. It wasn't a Super Tawny or anything, but it was generally, I believe it was the same plane there.
All right, let's get Douglas and Mark to comment. Douglas, Mark, what do you say?
Well, you know, Howard's probably only real friend was Jack Reel, who was an executive at Lockheed. And when the stand-in was moved from the Desert Inn Hotel to the Bahamas, he flew on a Lockheed aircraft, which was provided by Jack Reel. So, you know, Mark, what do you think?
You know, it could have been him. It's kind of hard to speculate on that. He, of course, was involved with the Constellation and development of it and things like that. And he used it in many of his airlines and TWA and so forth. So it could have been him. It's awful hard to speculate. I did have someone tell me that they were at the Nellis Tower in the early 70s, 71, 72, and they were working from the Nellis Tower. And his plane would come into to Nellis, the Air Force base there, and, you know, be taxied over to a hangar at that point in time. So I think he was involved with Area 51, but again, that's all speculation on our side.
All right, Mike is in Corpus Christi, Texas. Mike, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Yeah, hello. I'm from West Palm Beach. I got confused with the other person.
Ah, I had the wrong mic. Okay.
The question I have for your guests is the following. Did they use this facial recognition software on these pictures? of the hidden Howard Hughes and the real Howard Hughes and the people who were masquerading as him. Did you make any attempt to use that computerized systems where they can compare pictures and they get a 90% reading, then you know what's really, you know, the actual stuff? Did you do any research on that?
Okay, I did try that. I did try that on a picture of Nick that we had from 1991 and a picture of Howard is 1947, and put those in there. They're different facial expressions. And what they told me was they can't have 100% convincing of that because the facial expression was different and such a difference in the ages. Evidently that software works if you have the same facial expression and if you're close in age. Now, if there's other software that we can compare that with, I'd love to do it. So please, anyone out there who knows about software on this facial stuff, our first try wasn't terribly successful, but we're certainly love to try it again.
Mike in West Palm, thank you for that. Now, there is another interesting piece of evidence that was, I'm not sure if it was handed over to you by Eva McClellan, and this was a congressional pin. Tell me about that.
Well, this is a really fascinating and compelling piece of evidence, and Mark found this right after the first book was published. It's a lapel pin. It's graved United States or U.S. Congressional Advisory Board, and we weren't really sure if that was, we didn't know what it was, so Mark asked one of his friends who was a retired lieutenant general to look into it, and what he discovered was that it was a very special pin that went to major industrialists and defense contractors, and sometimes they would make an exception for someone like Howard Hughes, sometimes they would make an exception for someone like Dr. Henry Kissinger. Well, obviously, this man running around naked in the woods in Alabama, Nick Nicely, wasn't any Henry Kissinger, but what he was Howard Hughes, and that's very much the kind of person who would get the pin. The second interesting piece about this was that the pins were first struck by the American Security Council Foundation in 1981. Well, that's 5 years after Howard Hughes had supposedly died. So that meant whoever issued that pin to Nick, not only, you know, did he know that Nick was really Howard Hughes, but it happened 5 years after his supposed death. So then the next question was, okay, who would know that Hughes was Nick and that could potentially have gotten that pin? As it turns out, this American Security Council Foundation, one of the committee members was Nevada Senator Paul Laxalt. Paul Laxalt was a Nevada governor when Hughes had gone into his hotel shopping spree. And Hughes had also provided money for the state of Nevada to establish some educational and medical foundations. Laxalt had further said in his autobiography that he never felt Hughes had been properly recognized for his contributions to American defense. So that little pin, in all likelihood, traces right back to Senator Laxalt, who knew very well that Hughes was alive and well and living as Nick Nicely.
All right, I think we've got time for one more caller, and Tyler is back on the international line in London, Ontario. Tyler, welcome back to Coast AM.
Thank you very much. Apparently they do cell phone network maintenance around this time, so I apologize about getting cut off earlier.
Funny you mentioned that. I'm having the same issue on my cell.
First-time caller, long-time listener, love Coast to Coast. I'm really happy we've got a Canadian behind the desk tonight. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Just wanted to say hi to all my American neighbors. We love you guys through thick and thin, and we're here no matter what you need. To tonight's topic, I'm 31. Howard Hughes, all I know really of him is through The Aviator and through a bunch of, like, Mr. Burns references on The Simpsons. So, unfortunately, I'm pretty limited. I was kind of wondering if you guys could zoom out a little bit and give me a little bit of perspective. Like, is the Spruce Moose, is that thing, was that actually, like, a legitimate project? Does this have anything to do with it? And more to the point, why does he have a, why would there be a need for him to have an alternate identity? More to the point, why? What's the fascination behind that? What's the driving force behind that?
Okay, we just got a couple minutes here, so we'll try to get your answer squeezed in, Tyler. But thank you for checking back in with us. So the Spruce Goose, that was a legitimate project for sure.
Yes, that's correct. It was built out of sort of a plywood, a process named Duramold that was created by Hughes. And the idea was to make an aircraft that didn't require metal, because this was during the war, World War II. And metal was in short supply. So yes, that was a legitimate product and a project. And I've actually been aboard that aircraft, and it's quite fascinating.
And very quickly, why again did he feel the need to fake his death?
He was being sued by everybody, basically. There was no possible way that he was going to have anything like a peaceful retirement.
He had lawsuits
against him. And people were hunting him down, and he just needed to escape.
And Vernon Nicely, a.k.a. Howard Hughes, passed away at the ripe old age of 96 in the year 2001. What about Eva McClellan? What happened to Eva?
Well, Eva died in 2009. Interesting enough, Nick died November 15th, 2001. Eva died November 15th, 2009. And I was with her when she died. We were asking her questions, actually, 2 weeks prior to her death, and she was answering them just like she'd answered them 5-6 years earlier. Very, very smart, right up to the end. Wonderful lady. She was a very paranoid lady. When I met her, she liked Pepsi, she liked chocolate, and she liked classical music. And she relayed this story to me, I think, because she trusted me. But she was passed away. My wife and I went and did her service, of which he asked us to go do, and just an amazing, amazing lady with amazing story and amazing memory.
Well, Douglas and Mark, you've rewritten the history books on this one. This is a remarkable story, and I commend you for it, and I thank you for spending some time with us on Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you so much. I just enjoyed this so much.
Yeah, Richard, thank you very much. This is a lot of fun.
Oh, my pleasure. And again, it's Boxes, The Secret Life of Howard Hughes, Douglas Wellman, Mark Music, and now in its second edition, new photos, new interviews, new evidence. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
Good night. All right, on the other side, we will speak with Tawny Cullen about her remarkable son, Josiah, who suffers from autism. Autism stole his words. God gave him a voice. Stay tuned. Kim Carnes taking us into the break with Crazy in the Night right here on Coast to Coast AM.